let's get underway. In terms of sequence of reporting officers, is there a plan in place about who we're going to hear from in what particular order?
Yes, there is. So I've got four witnesses that you'll hear from today. The first one will be Erin Mogan, followed by, so Erin will deal with the infrastructure designation for the council, and then followed by John Kyle, and then deal with the Wanaka Airport, and then followed by Ms. Gilbardi and Mr. Charles.
Alrighty, good. And then we'll go to Rebecca Holden for...
Yes, so then Mr. Winchester will be presenting his legal submission for the council in its capacity as the regulatory authority.
Right.
So I'm here in the council's capacity as the requiring authority.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, look, I can signal that I've read through all of the reports a number of times. I've read your legal submissions. I'm assuming this copy here, the hard copy, is the same as what was emailed to me.
Yeah.
Yep, so I've read those through. And to date, we've had a fairly useful hearing running through the issues. They've kind of been both confined and sort of refined as we've gone. So I'm not necessarily bristling with questions, but I have a number for the various officers. But not I can signal not a great deal. All right, so I don't really need you to read through your legal submissions.
Okay.
I'm happy if you want to, point me in the direction of some points that you want to emphasise, but I really don't need a read through.
Perhaps it might just be useful, in light of the discussion yesterday around the Northern airstrip, which was quite detailed, there were just a couple of points that I added into my submissions late yesterday afternoon in response to some of the matters raised. One in particular being the extending the extent of the designation. So I've said quite clearly in my submission that it's not the council's intention to expand the footprint of the designation. And that there are a number of reasons for that, and one of them, which I haven't actually specified in my submission, but one of them is that the council may, in the future, look to do other things on that piece of reserve, and its intention in keeping the airport activities quite confined to the landing strip is intentional in that regard. I'd just like to highlight that.
And can you give me any signal about what the nature of those other things might be?
So the airport site is currently being looked at for the purpose of a wastewater treatment disposal field. And that wouldn't interfere with the aircraft operation, but it would limit the disposal field sits under the ground around the airstrip, and it would... My understanding is that it will prevent buildings being located on top of the disposal field area. So it's the council's intention to work with the operators that currently have buildings there to ensure that they can remain, but it will look to do that through a separate process and consolidate the buildings in hopefully the same area that it puts its pumping station for the disposal field. But that's it's all in the very early stages at the moment, so we didn't want to hinder the wastewater disposal field by extending the airport designation over the entire reserve.
Okay. And any other points you wanted to draw my attention to?
In relation to the Glenorchy airstrip, there was a lot of discussion yesterday about aligning the designation with the reserve management plan, and I've set out in my submissions that the reserve management plan is a separate tool to the designation, and it doesn't follow from having adopted the reserve management plan that the designation must also accord with the reserve management plan. So there are other ways to facilitate the things that the reserve management plan identifies for the future. And that again goes back to why the council is quite happy with the current extent of its designation. There are other tools in place, or other tools under the RMA available for operators to use to develop the site in accordance with the reserve management plan. And I think that's probably. In respect of the Milky Airstrip. And if you're happy with everything else that I have included in my submission, perhaps we'll move on to view from Mr.
Well, just a few queries and questions first, if that's okay. In the submission, you canvass the issue that came up with Glen Orchid, which was designation, reserve management plan, licences and leases, particularly in relation to noise. And the Wayuna submitters were quite keen on the idea of sort of putting forward the proposition, well, look, regulation of noise, dealing with noise, that's an RMA issue, and that's the best place for it, deal with it in terms of a noise management plan attached to the designation. If we drift off and deal with it kind of directly between the council and the operators in the form of leases or licences, then maybe the community members are not going to be part and parcel of that process. Mm-hmm. So do you have any points of view you'd like to share with me on that particular point? I know you've covered it in the submission to a degree, but anything additional?
Yeah. Ms. Galavati will probably address it in more detail, but perhaps one point I'd like to make is that but the reserve management plan sets out a process for the council considering its leasing license arrangements, and one of the matters that will be addressed is that there will be a community representative on a panel that will consider the license applications and then make a recommendation to the council to either approve or decline the license. So there will be community involvement in the leasing license process. Whether that will extend to notification of the leases or licences under the Reserves Act is not yet clear. It is a local purpose reserve, so there is no mandatory obligation or requirement on the council to notify the licences, which they will be licences and perhaps not leases. So there will be community involvement at that stage, and the council is well aware of the noise issues at the Glenorchy Airstrip, and it will be engaging a noise expert as part of that process to better understand the current use, which it's committed to establishing. It will then use the noise expert to better understand whether the current use represents an appropriate level of noise at the Glenorchy Airstrip. And I noted in my submission that neither the reserve management plan nor the designation gets us around our duty under Section 16 to avoid unreasonable noise. So the members are concerned about an RMA mechanism to control noise, they will always have that Section 16 duty. One of the reasons why the council considers that the licence arrangement is more appropriate for controlling the noise is the enforcement mechanism that we would have available. The enforcement under the RMA is a very prescriptive process, and we can go down that path, and we will if it's necessary, but it's much easier to revoke a licence if there's a clause in the licence which allows us to do that, and it's our intention that there will be.
All right, so are you... this issue about community consultation around the makeup of the licences, so are you reasonably clear that there will or won't be kind of a submission process around these licences or leases?
Ms. Galavati is probably better placed to answer that question, but it's my understanding that it's not the council's intention at this stage to notify the licences.
Right, because yesterday it was talked about broadly, and that was an issue I had because we really didn't have clarity around that kind of reserve management process. We were talking about leases and licenses, we were talking about the submission process, but nobody really seemed to know what the council thinking on the issue was. So I'd really like that to be sort of cleared up for me, if that's at all possible. Because the residents group, I think, were taking some level of comfort from the possibility that there'd be a submission process available to them.
Ms. Gilardi was involved in the development of the reserve management plan. She's probably best placed to walk you through what the council's kind of thinking on that process.
Right, now that would be helpful if I can have that. All right. Now, the other query and question I had for you was in relation to designation 29. This is the one with the event centre. Now, it's a question of kind of assessment of evidence, if you like. So that's why I'm asking you as a legal person. And an issue arose out of the Queenstown Airport's presentation about Mr. Charles's evidence. And they were suggesting to me that Mr. Charles's evidence in relation to the daycare activity proposed within the designation was somewhat qualified, in that while he seemed to be suggesting, provided the building was appropriately designed for noise-sensitive activities, then that was one thing, but the qualification was he was really saying, well, only use the event centre in the instance that there isn't another readily available childcare opportunity for another facility somewhere else. That's the thrust of the airport interpretation of Mr. Charles's evidence. Now, clearly, I'll be asking Mr. Charles that query and question, but I wondered if you had a view on whether you thought his evidence was so qualified. I think the relevant paragraphs were 3.5 of his evidence, and it was a contrast of that with the bullet pointers in his executive summary, and that's how the issue kind of played out. So if you have a wee look at those paragraphs for me.
Sorry, was it 3.5?
Yes, I think it's 3.5. So we were looking at paragraph 2.1b, Mr. Charles' evidence on page 4. The final sentence, I do not consider this to be an overriding factor if there are not equivalent sites available. And then over at 5.3, I've got the numbers around the wrong way, page 7.
question. Sorry, could you just repeat the question?
Well, the way it was put to me was that Mr. Charles was really saying that appropriate treatment of the normally treatment of the building was one thing, but the other issue was if there was an equivalent site available elsewhere, then that's what should happen,
right.
That the childcare facility should be elsewhere.
Right.
And Mr. Kyle was making the point on behalf of the airport company that, well, look, isn't it a better approach just to sort of avoid the issue altogether? Why have this noise-sensitive activity take place when there might be other available options?
I think the point perhaps is that there aren't any other identified available sites for the childcare facilities in the area, and the reason why there are childcare facilities at the event centre site are because of all of the other facilities that are also already there. So I don't think there is anywhere else in the district where you could have a childcare facility next to playing fields, swimming pools, is there a hydro site out there, I don't know, but the basketball courts, all of those facilities are also available to use as part of the childcare facility. So
yeah. I don't think there was an issue about childcare facility being provided when people attending the event centre were actually making use of those other facilities at the same time, but it was the extension of the childcare facility to be broader than that.
Yeah, but the children can also use those facilities. So it's a desirable site for a childcare facility because there are all those other facilities, not only for use by their parents when they might be in the daycare, but by the children themselves.
And the circumstance when the parent or the child minder isn't using the facilities. That was the point that was made in relation to the airport submission, saying, well, why should the that offer be extended?
Well, I think Mr. Charles' point is that if a building is acoustically treated, then there is no noise issue for children to be using that building. And if there are other areas where the children are going to be on the site, if they are... they contain the activity sensitive to aircraft noise, and they will also be required to be acoustically treated in accordance with the conditions of the designation. So it's a suitable site for the childcare facility because of all of the other facilities that are also available in close proximity. If the children aren't going to be exposed to aircraft noise because of the acoustic treatment of the buildings, it seems a sensible use of the land. Obviously in accordance with the
certain designation. Right, so when we have a look at the sentence in 2.1b, I do not consider this to be an overriding factor if there are not equivalent sites available. Your kind of interpretation of that, is that a qualification or what is it?
It's almost a bit of a contradiction in my reading. My thesis is that the exhibition should preferably be located outside, but I don't consider that to be an overriding factor if there are not.
As I say, I'll talk to Mr. Charles about it, but I'm just interested in your view from just trying to sort of interpret what's on the page.
I couldn't really offer a view, I'm afraid, without getting clarification from Mr. Child exactly as to what he was doing.
All right, that sounds like a plan.
Right.
The last question I had for you was on the closed landfills, how the plan is to remove the designations for some of those closed landfills. And I know the evidence from the reporting officer is that if there were further works required sometime in the future, obviously there's a benefit with the designation remaining in place. But she made the point that perhaps if further works were required, then a consent under the NES would be needed anyway. Mm-hmm. So any kind of possible advantage of retention of the designation really doesn't amount to much. I'm quite aware that issues that emerge over time with landfills, particularly retired landfills, can be quite troubling. So I was really sort of just wanting to test with you, I know the submission's clear on the point, but the wisdom of actually dealing with the designations in the way proposed for these landfills.
So my understanding of landfills and the issues that follow from them once they're closed is that they're generally regional council issues, so discharges and the like, and those would require consent from the regional council, which the designation obviously doesn't serve any purpose for. To the extent that consents are required from the district council, in removing these designations, the council has accepted that it might need to seek resource consents in the future, but the majority of the landfills, apart from some small areas, is on council land. And then again, if we have to get consents for earthworks, which would be a district council requirement, we'd also have to presumably get consents under the NES, and you can't designate your way around the NES requirements either. So we will be seeking consents either from the regional council or from the district council under the NES. So we, given the implications of the designations on the landowners and the concerns that they raised, we saw this as being an appropriate outcome or appropriate solution to their concerns, recognising that we will inevitably have to get consent from either the regional council or the district council if issues were to arise.
Right, okay. So you've kind of gone through an exercise and you're thinking that on balance that's a better outcome.
Yeah.
All right, and last question related to, can I just use the phrase, sort of general infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
The report makes it clear that in most instances that those sorts of facilities, the stormwater and matters of that sort, are on council land. But occasionally the phrasing generally comes through. So is it the case that some of these facilities are in fact not on council land, and the designation is going to be extending over land that's not under council control?
My understanding is that where the designations were originally proposed on land not owned by the council, they have now been withdrawn, or we're seeking to withdraw them. So,
right.
In particular, that relates to the Kirimoko part,
yep.
The two designations out there. We might have to check with Ms. Mugan.
Well, can I just have that cleared up? Because when I read through the reports earlier in time, that comment came up, and I marked that up because I just wanted to understand, is there land that's not owned by the council that's going to be affected by these designations? And I did read about some being withdrawn, but it would be good to know whether or not there are still some extending onto land which is owned by others.
I can clarify that.
All right, that's my series of questions for you.
Should we perhaps start with Ms. Little?
Good, thank you.
Ms.
All right, well, if it's there, that'll be helpful.
I'm the Infrastructure Maintenance and Operations Manager for the Queen's Sandwich District Council. I filed evidence with respect to designations that the Council has included in respect of its infrastructure assets. My statement today summarises the key issues that arose out of the evidence that I submitted on the 23rd of October, and I confirm that I've read and reviewed the legal submissions put forward by Council. As already outlined in my evidence, Council's objectives in designating infrastructure facilities and to ensure their protection from adverse land uses or activities adjacent to the facilities, as well as to ensure that Council can provide for their ongoing maintenance and operations into the future. These proposed designations generally relate to stormwater, water supply and wastewater facilities. These are facilities such as stormwater retention basins, water and wastewater pump stations and water reservoirs. In addition to the amendments to existing designations with regard to mapping errors, legal descriptions outlined within the evidence, there's also around 25 new stormwater designations and around 50 new water and wastewater designations that have been proposed. In line with the developments in the region, particularly in relation to new subdivisions, we've had new assets that have been constructed and yet not formally identified and protected by way of designation to date. In preparing the proposed district plan, the Council's reviewed these infrastructure assets and proposes to include them as new designation requirements. As discussed, Council's received submissions in respect of the proposed closed landfill designations and also in relation to the designations for stormwater soakage basins at Kirimoku Park in Wanaka. As discussed, Council's considered it appropriate to withdraw the stormwater designations on the basis that they're not necessary to achieve Council's objectives. Council's reporting officer also recommended that a noise control condition be imposed on those designations that have the potential to create adverse noise in sensitive environments. In my experience, in the experience of managing Council's infrastructure, the types of infrastructure referred to generally wouldn't create a significant amount of noise. However, for consistency, Council has agreed to the inclusion of such a condition.
All right. No, thank you. And just picking up on the issue that we were just discussing about any designations of this nature, this type, affecting land not owned by Council, can you clear that up for me?
So, with respect to the types of infrastructure assets that Council would have on land not owned by Council, with respect to some subdivisions where there's infrastructure that is actually on private land, we have wastewater pump stations, for example, where we have a right to occupy within a private subdivision that then pumps out to the main network. Those would be the sort of examples of infrastructure that sits on private land. I'd need to go through and just review whether or not any of those new designations relate to situations like that, but I couldn't tell you that.
Right. with subdivisions, obviously, commonly what happens is that type of infrastructure is vested in the council, so that's something that doesn't occur here.
It's something that generally occurs here, but there are instances where it hasn't.
Where it hasn't. And that's where the designation tool is sought to be utilised.
I understand that's where the designation tool has been sought to be utilised previously. I just have to check whether or not there's any of those instances that haven't been withdrawn in this case.
Yeah, that'd just be handy if I knew that around that. Has that occurred in the past then, is it, where a designation has been utilised? Situation where, if you say pump station, developed as a consequence of a subdivision or an activity similar to that, but that hasn't vested in the council. That site hasn't vested in the council on subdivision approval, and the designation tool's then been used.
My understanding is that that's the case, but again, I'd have to check.
Okay. Are you aware of any response from the landowner to utilising the designation tool?
Not specific to utilising the designation tool. Definitely in response to the infrastructure being there, because we sometimes have instances where we still need to tidy up our formal rights to access that infrastructure, which is a process we're working through. But generally, once people understand the importance of that infrastructure, nobody wants to be without it, without having the ability to pump their wastewater back to the main network.
Have there been any circumstances where the landowner has said, well, if you're going to designate, I want you to purchase the land?
Not that I'm aware of, but I need to go back and see through our records if that had been the case. I wasn't here at the time of the last district plan designation was put in place.
Would I be sort of safe to assume that the circumstance or the number of occasions where this arises, that is, a facility on another party's land, which the council seeks now to designate, it's fairly rare?
Yes. Most of council's infrastructure is on land to the council.
Yeah. Well, if you could just provide me with that info, that information, that would be good. The facilities that you talk about in your summary and in your evidence around stormwater, water supply and wastewater facilities, these are large-scale facilities. They're not facilities that emerge from a subdivision development, for example.
No, they are the smallest, particularly with regard to wastewater pump stations, stormwater detention. Those are the things that commonly arise out of these subdivisions. Commonly, our water pumps, wastewater and wastewater pump stations, for example, are just a small sort of hut-type shed that people don't really realise what it's there for.
Right.
Often not much more than an electrical box.
In the instance that the council owns the land upon which the infrastructure is located, in some ways, I was sort of struggling a little to understand the advantage to the council by going down this designation path. Your evidence does sort of touch on it, but
I guess with respect to, again, I'm not a planning engineer, I seek their advice dependent on activities on what I'd require a consent for. But we do have instances from time to time where the infrastructure that sits below a pump station, for example, the wet well, which is like the holding tank that liquid would come into, will fail, well, hopefully not fail, will go in and repair that ahead of time and review it. But that can require heavy infrastructure, diggers, etc., on site for us actually to remove the existing holding tanks, put in new ones. We quite regularly have to have cranes to lift pumps in and out of our pump stations for renewal and replacement, as well as also work to the inlet and outlet pipes into those facilities.
Thank you. Now, the table attached to your principal evidence, I'll read it a few times elsewhere, but just the colour coding again, can you just remind me about that?
I think I'd actually have to defer on the colour coding piece of it.
Because we've got reds, greens and blues.
My understanding of colour coding is to distinguish between those that are new designations and those that are corrections to existing designations.
At paragraph 1.9 of my submissions, I've just listed the colours and what they mean. So designations rolled over from the operative plan without modification shown in green.
Oh, that's right. Okay. Now that's all good.
Thank
you. All right. Thank you very much indeed. That's been very helpful.
Thank you.
Right, my name is Carl.
Morning, sir. I have prepared a summary, but I'm wondering if it might not be all that worthwhile reading it to you, because a number of the themes inherent in it are consistent with what we talked about yesterday. I don't want to go over old ground. And I just wonder if it might be more useful if I just take you to the notice of requirements and just show you what is proposed at one of the airport in the way of changes, and briefly explain why it is those changes that we made. And in essence, that covers the matters inherent in my summary anyway.
We can do that. I just wonder first, though, if I, as I say, I've read the material, and also the 42A report. And the key issue coming up for Wanaka is the suggestion from the 42A report that the assessment of effects required isn't fulsome. Now, you appreciate that under 168A3, when considering a requirement, any submission received, etc., subject part 2, consider the effects on the environment of allowing the requirement. Now, as I read your evidence, the way in which you've gone about that part is there's two elements, I guess, to the way you've addressed that. You've pushed me in the direction of the Makarua case in terms of aerodromes and airports and the range of activities that could be expected. And that's fine so far as it goes, but I'm just sort of a little troubled that that's kind of a big broad generalisation, and I wanted to better understand the effects of what's here proposed.
Yes.
So your second line is to say, well, look, the modifications they're overlapped with the plan change. I forgot the number, plan change 29 or something.
26.
Mm-hmm. And you say, well, they're the two approaches that I read from your evidence about how you deal with this issue of effects of the modification on the environment.
Mm. Yeah, I have to say I was a little bit surprised at the reaction of the reporting officer in terms of this issue of effects. It seems that she's concerned that there are quite significant changes inherent in the modification sought. And that's why I was quite keen to take you to the notice, because my view is the changes aren't that significant, and really what we're dealing with is an updating and a modernisation, if you like, of the expression of activities carried out at Wanaka Airport, rather than anything more substantive than that. And the list of activities permitted, which is set out in the notice, we took some considerable care to tailor that to the Wanaka situation, understanding what happens there. So the range of uses isn't, for example, quite as broad as the Queensland Airport Corporation was seeking yesterday with respect to the district's major airport. That they're more specifically geared at what we would term a broad range of airside type activities, and much more specific to the aviation, or the types of aviation activities that occur at Wanaka Airport. So the first point I'd like to make is that the shift between what's currently provided for by the designation and what is proposed isn't that significant. It's just a matter of modernisation in the light of that McElroy case and what currently occurs at the airport itself. The other point is that the performance standards, whilst there is some refinement to those with respect to buildings, for example, aren't terribly significant. I think the suggested alteration in building height is about a metre. and of course, excuse me, the matters we talked about yesterday with respect to processing of outline plans equally applies in Wanaka or Wanaka Airport, if something new is proposed there. I detected from the report that there was quite a lot of concern that activities unrelated to the airport activity could occur at Wanaka Airport. And my view is, you know, having had a fresh look at the range of activities specified as being permitted by the designation, I think that concern is a little bit overstated.
Now, just remind me, is it proposed to include a kind of a provision around ancillary and related to type conditions?
Well, if, I don't know if you've got the notes in front of you. It's appendix A to the notice of requirement.
Have you got a spare copy just handy there, just so I mean.
Sorry, I didn't mean to add that for sure, but somewhere buried document. Yes.
Just
a page. Does that have a page?
This has got my
scribble. Perhaps I'll use a bit of farms and I can give you mine. Appendix A, I think, should have been handed the document where it's headed E1 aerodrome purposes.
Yep.
And then it has a range of permitted activities. And to answer your question directly, if you look at E, retail activities, restaurants, other food and beverage facilities, including takeaway food facilities and industrial and commercial activities, provided they are connected with and ancillary to the use of the airport. So insofar as those activities are concerned, there's the direct connection. The remaining activities, if you just have a browse through A through E, and G for that matter, in my view are very much focused on what you would expect to describe the aviation type activities of the era, and you feel like one.
But it was the little clutch of activities in F that was causing the reporting officer concern, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's my understanding. And my view is that that proviso that they're connected with and ancillary to the use of the airport should at least help to alleviate the concern in that sense. The other interesting point, you know, to note, I think, is I mentioned yesterday that Queenstown Airport was land constrained. The same can be said for Wanaka Airport. Whilst it might appear like a vast open expanse of land, the fact is there is very little land available there for future development. And in fact, that has presented some challenges.
The nature of these activities, the purpose for them is to serve the needs of the travelling public. So that's both a push and kind of a pull factor, isn't it, in terms of it drives it, but it also limits it.
Yes. The other change made relates to the obstacle limitation service designation, but that more or less a bunch of small scale tidy ups. And the other point you may have noted is the extent of the designation. There's a drawing on the back of that document I handed you. The extent of the designation has been increased, proposed to be increased. And just show you where that land is, because it might not have been immediately evident from looking at the documents for you, because it's a tiny piece. You see the cluster of development, which is the terminal, and you can see a small sliver of land.
Yes, that's the recommended land acquisition.
That
is 1127 hectares.
That's the suggested extension. And the reason for doing that is to preserve adequate separation between the runway and any potential obstacle. And enable, in the fullness of time, the construction of a code-C taxiway that's required. So you can see to the left of that little sliver of land, dotted track which indicates where the airport's master plan has suggested that taxiway would be constructed, when and if that's required in the future.
Alright, that's good. just turn to your evidence, if I may. At paragraph 422, you finish that paragraph with a sentence. It is therefore important to understand that today's airport usage scenario is not the ultimately authorised outcome for Wanaka Airport. I just wanted you to explain what you mean by that sentence.
Yes, that sentence should be read in the context of the rest of the paragraph, which reflects upon what occurred via Plan Change 26. Plan Change 26 was a revisit of the airport noise controls and an updating of those requirements in the Ministry of Plan to reflect the forecast future use of one of the airport. In a similar way to Plan Change 25 was promoted at Queensland. So, where Plan Change 26 ended up was to forecast the use of the airport up to the year 2036. And the plan was set around that future scenario, if you like, particularly the management of the aircraft noise. So that sentence should be read in that context. The plan currently provides for the use of one vehicle up to the year 2036, insofar as management of the aircraft noise is concerned.
And where is Plan Change 26 actually at now?
It's off.
It's off.
Yes, part of the plan now. Mm-hmm. No challenge to it.
So that is just being picked up by the proposed plan?
Yes.
Again, similar kind of conversation arises about the freight hub issue. So, do you have anything sort of additional to add on that point?
Not a whole lot. One for equal isn't a huge conveyor of freight by any stretch of the imagination. Between scheduled aircraft, the airport, some freight, to a very minor extent, was conveyed by the airport, but certainly one for us is currently a huge conveyor of freight. If freight is brought in and out of Queenstown by air, it generally go by Queenstown. One example of that occurring is the cray fishery in Milford. Helicopter there to catch across the Queensland Airport and have that in Asia as quickly as possible, still alive often.
A broader question for you. Given your sort of familiarity with airport-related issues, you told me yesterday that you've been involved with the airport here for quite some years. You're generally aware of the speed of change. You mentioned yesterday that there's lots of developments occurring. You're always amazed at what's happening at the airport here in Queenstown. You're alive to the issue of speed of change in the tourism industry, growth rates, matters of that sort. you make mention in your evidence that Wanaka at one time was used by National Airline for landing in planes. You've talked about the constraints at Queenstown Airport. So, piecing all of that together, in your opinion, is there a prospect that levels of activity at Wanaka could rather quickly mushroom and grow?
Yes. At some point in the future, Queenstown Airport will be, and the airspace around it will be so utilised by scheduled aircraft that it will become increasingly difficult for the other functions carried out there to survive on that site. For example, the general aviation. And whilst that, according to current forecasts, is quite a long way off at this point, ultimately you might see the situation unfold where those activities have to be displaced from the city and relocated somewhere else. Where they might go is a really difficult question. You heard yesterday about Wenoki, you're hearing today about Wanaka. There could be the prospect that that type of activity is forced to relocate to an airfield like Wanaka. The other issue that shouldn't be lost sight of for Wanaka is whilst scheduled aircraft no longer visit, that could quickly change again. One of the key reasons that those flights were taken away is because Air New Zealand was getting out of that smaller aircraft type. They used to fly the Beach 1900D into that airfield, and they had a longer term plan to decommission those aircraft and upgauge to Q300s and ATR type aircraft. And one of them just wasn't quite big enough to sustain a service that had service with that type of aircraft. But Wanaka is a rapidly growing place, and lots of things happening in the town itself to expand the town from a commercial residential point of view. And at some point in the future, it will gain its own critical mass sufficient to be attractive again, I suspect, to an airline operating an aircraft of it. Size of the Q300, for example. So the return of scheduled aircraft to Wanaka is certainly a real possibility in the future. The other thing that has occurred at Wanaka in recent times is it's become quite an attractive place for NASA to operate. Gigantic weather balloons, and they ran some trials a few years ago to see how suitable Wanaka was for that function. Found it to be inherently suitable. And looking at it quickly ramping up their activities out of that area. So, lots of different possibilities.
So accepting that and accepting there might be rapid rates of growth or responses to those growth rates at the airport manifesting itself in terms of a different offering at the airport, you don't think that there are any effects-related issues arising from that that merit some consideration?
Well, all those things are aviation-related activities, and the existing designation anticipates those types of things. The challenge for the operator of that airport is how it might accommodate some of those activities in the future, because, as I mentioned before, the airport is land constrained. And the ability for one of the airport to expand is actually pretty limited at the moment. And if some of these things occur in the future, then it's likely that some master planning will have to look at perhaps expanding the late holding. And if that occurs, then the effects of doing so will need to be assessed at that time.
And in relation to, if you like, the ancillary activities, like we've discussed, retail, restaurants and food offerings and the like, if they were to grow rapidly, your position on effects on the rest of the community,
they would only ever grow, I think, in conjunction with that aviation activity. I can't see Wellington Airport being a destination shopping centre in its own right. If you leave Wanaka and drive out in that direction, you're going to have to drive past the Three Parks development, which specifically geared to cater to the community's retail needs. And that's beginning to build up now. It's on the edge of town. It seemed unlikely to me that you would bypass a facility like that to go out to one of the airports and get a coffee.
One other little query, really. In your evidence at paragraph 441, where you're setting out the objectives of the designation, you've got a sub-paragraph there, to act as an alternative for certain aircraft types unable to land at Queenstown because of weather conditions. What types of aircraft did you have in mind?
That would normally be general aviation type aircraft or helicopters.
I see.
Say, for example, the Milford flight team, in circumstances where they couldn't return to Queenstown, they would perhaps divert to Wanaka or Invercargill.
Right. No, look, that's been very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. Right, well, starting off, Mr. Charles, you've heard the conversation I've had around parts of your evidence. Can you deal with that first up?
On the Queenstown Events Centre, or the political comment between 2.1 billion and 5.3. So I've tried to stick to my knitting and talk about the acoustic factors, and in terms of the noise, if you've got two identical sites, you put the sensitive activity in the one that's not affected by noise. Probably been too broad there. In terms of the Queenstown Event Centre, it's a unique location by a transport node with community facilities on the site already, so clearly there isn't an identical site somewhere else which gives you that choice. So if there's a sensitive activity that's meshing in with that location and those facilities, then I'm not suggesting that there's an equivalent site somewhere else.
When you use the phrase meshing in, what do you mean? because I better give you some context. When the airport was submitting, they were saying, well, look, if the parent or childminder carer was going to the facility for an exercise class and they dropped off their child at the care centre, that's fine. But what they were complaining about, if you like, was that somebody not making use of the facility but going there primarily for childcare, well, essentially solely for childcare. They were sort of saying, well, look, that plus extending childcare to accommodate that activity or that demand was something that they weren't particularly happy about.
So in terms of the noise effects on the child, whether the parent is swimming or has gone down the road to pack and save is largely irrelevant.
Well, we had an interesting conversation around that, and that's what I was suggesting, that they were saying, well, you know, there are limits, for example, the person coming to the event centre, they might be going for a gym class, so they're there for 30 or 40 minutes and they're off, but somebody on a shopping expedition might be a lot longer. They talked about also if a child was in the care centre, then if they were there for a long period of time, they might be expected to spend some of that time outside, so they wouldn't get the protective elements available inside the building. And they were talking in this sort of sense, and they were also signalling that, well, there are other childcare facilities in close proximity to the event centre anyway.
So I can't comment on, I'm not familiar with other childcare facilities in proximity to the event centre. I think it seems to be getting awfully complicated about a relatively simple matter. That,
oh, good, that's what you're here for.
Yeah. If there is somewhere else away from all the sensitive activity, great. Just to take a Frankton school is sitting underneath flight paths and affected by aircraft noise. Ideally, Frankton school wouldn't be there. It'd be somewhere not affected by noise. But it's in the community where people can walk to it, and there's a whole load of other benefits, presumably why that site is appropriate for Frankton school. The same Queenstown Event Centre, it's sitting on a transport node. It's got existing infrastructure there. If having a childcare centre on that site makes sense in terms of the existing infrastructure and the transport connections and the availability of the pools and so forth, but I don't think the aircraft noise issue should be a fatal flaw that stops utilisation of those resources. And I think the only reason my wording is perhaps, well, again, I'm trying hard to stick just to the noise issues when really it's a broader sort of planning matter probably at hand, but it seems to have got worked up into something a bit too complicated. Certainly the notion of trying to control where the parent's gone, so this child can't stay here but the parent's sort of disappeared the wrong way down the road, it seems an administrative nightmare.
Now then, moving to Glenorchy then, pretty much coming out of the presentation for the users of the Glenorchy airstrip and the residents, there's a broad range of conversation both arising from evidence received and also their presentation during the course of the week. But the key issue that seemed to emerge out of all of that was what's the best process, what's the best device to utilise in terms of dealing with noise. Probably, it was a little hard to gauge, but probably more so in terms of the potential for more noise as distinct from current levels of noise, with the exception of the microlight activity. That's the way it seemed to come across to me anyway from the residents group. So you'll come down in your position seems to be reading the evidence that you think that dealing with the noise issue in the context of the reserve management plan and the tools available under that plan is preferable to dealing with it as a condition attached to the designation.
Yes. I think given if you're starting from scratch and you didn't have the reserve management plan or designation conditions, then you might write up. But when I was asked to look at this, I read the reserve management plan and went through it. It already contains all the relevant issues. And I'm not familiar with those processes, but I've had the licensing system explained to me, and it actually seems to be an awful lot more efficient than resource management act processes for ensuring those outcomes are achieved.
How would, you know, again, it's possibly outside your area, but given that you've had that conversation, that maybe allows me to ask this question of you. If we're looking at licenses as being the appropriate approach, tool and process, how would the issue of cumulative effects be dealt with? You know, how do you know when you reach the threshold point that you've got too many operators, you've issued too many licenses? How is that going to be dealt with?
So the reserves management plan contains a very clear objective or policy to maintain activity at current levels, more or less. So the council officer, when they're issuing licences, if they're issuing licences for each operator to maintain their own activity at the same level as they're currently operating, then you'll end up with total activity within the envelope that you're seeking. So the only problem would be if operator A seeks to have more activity than they're currently undertaking. And that would have to be at the expense of operators B and C, who would then have to have their activity constrained. My understanding is that the council is simply going to seek for each operator to maintain their individual activity at the current level, so that cumulative issue shouldn't be a complicated system to ensure that occurs.
So, just to help me with that, it might roll out, would it, in terms of a current operator, the license or whatever the tool used is, might authorise a certain number of takeoffs and landings, or
absolutely yes. So every license, my expectation is that every license will have no more than this many takeoffs a day, and no many, whether it's a daily or a weekly or an annual average, there'd be a series of limits on the number of flights. Reading through Mr. Hunt's evidence, and I'm sorry, I haven't heard his responses to questions yesterday, we're largely in agreement. We both agree that activity needs to be capped, and it's the mechanism by which it's capped is a potential difference. But limiting the number of flights is a very pragmatic way to cap the activity.
Yeah, no, that's the way I read the evidence between you both, that you are largely agreed. But it was the mechanism, the process, or the tool to achieve the outcome.
Yes.
And of course, even his preferred approach in terms of a noise management plan, it was simply attaching the need to develop a noise management plan as a condition to the designation. And there's a lot more work that needed to be done to build that plan.
One thing that slightly confused me in listening to your questions earlier was, from everything I understand, the reserves management plan has been a consultative process with input from all parties. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of questions about when does the community get to input in this next process. To an extent, that would be really suggesting a process that's happened. That we've got a plan, it's got an agreed objective to cap activity. And so I'm not sure what's the plan also in terms of not overflying certain areas. That's in there. All those issues have been aired through as I understand it, a public process, and that's now set. Mm-hmm. And so the mechanisms of making sure that you only allow 10 flights a day instead of 50 or whatever the numbers are. I mean, I'm not sure what the value of further community input to those mechanics. is often a sort of an oversight process. I don't think there's new issues that need to be flushed out through in terms of the sort of managing the noise effects and identifying the noise effects.
Well, that may be so, but I think the way in which the way in the position was presented was a concern about some elements of existing activities and a concern about how the potential for increase in activity would be dealt with. So, you know, that's the way, particularly the way the evidence was presented and the way the conversation with the witnesses went when I tried to better understand what the core or kernel of their concerns were.
And from Mr. Hunt's evidence, so in terms of the increase, so as I've said, there is to be no increase, so that is, I think, the part is largely in agreement.
Well, that's contained, I agree.
The effects of the existing activity, in what Mr. Hunt's written, he's talked about the air at toe on the hang gliding operation, climbing above the residential areas, and the management plan says flight paths got to be taken away from the residential areas. So that issue, if that's occurring at the moment, then I agree that would be undesirable, but the mechanism's already gone through the process, with those same concerns, as I understand it, were raised through the management plan development.
Right. Well, can we just touch then on the issue that's causing concern about the microlite activity?
We're talking about the hang gliding tug.
Yes, I am. In conversation with the witnesses, I was trying to understand. Is there some kind of operational need as to why the activity occurs above the settled area? And the thinking was that, well, yes, there is an operational need, and that's because it's safer for that activity to occur above land as distinct from out over the lake. Do you have any understanding of that? I appreciate it's possibly outside your area of expertise.
No, I can't comment on the safety aspect.
The other point was made that, coming back to the management plan in place, this activity isn't supposed to cause these effects, if you like, and I was told conversations had occurred with the operator, but the operation is still continuing. So they were the signal was that, well, notwithstanding that this issue had been discussed and aired through that consultation process, compliance with the understanding just wasn't happening.
Yeah. I had a thought in your previous question is about the issue over land. That there's plenty of land without houses in the area, so if there's a land lake issue,
yeah.
You can still avoid overflying the residential areas. In terms of the other issue, compliance, so once the tandem hang gliding operation is operating in terms of the licence, if they're blatantly flying over residential areas, then the enforcement process under that licence can be invoked.
Yeah. And for now, again, it's kind of on the fringe of your area of expertise, but presumably you'd say, well, somebody from the council could go along and talk to this operator and get them to desist this activity if it was causing issues. But
my understanding is that as of today, that operator can't operate from Glenorchy without a licence. Because I don't understand that the management plan's operative.
That is the case.
But they are operating, aren't they?
They're operating without their licence. In the interim period, while we try to sort out the licence.
Yeah, because I was given correspondence from the council, I think dated this month, where the council is going about trying to conclude that licensing process.
Yeah.
So in the interim, these people are still operating.
And I imagine that if an operator doesn't operate with good practice, then he's highly unlikely to get a license.
that's all clear to me. So unless you've got anything else you want to draw my attention to.
On noise limits, I think about my evidence, we don't have the information on which noise limits can be set at the moment. So if you were minded to use noise limits as a control, there would need to be an exercise conducted before you could confirm what the appropriate noise limits were.
Yes.
I know Mr. Hans has put some numbers in there, but there could be a raft of unintended consequences of plucking one of those numbers out at this stage without actually knowing what.
Well, I did discuss some of that with him. Some of the other witnesses as well, because the approach was, well, look, in the interim, let's deal with it by putting in, if you like, in my loose language, a threshold noise number, which is generally accepted as, protecting the existing environment. So let's not be troubled about trying to measure what happens now, but let's just put that threshold number in place. And that'll do the trick. And I raised the possibility with both Mr. Hunt and other witnesses, well, possibly that could lead to significant constraints on the operators. And they accepted that, but then went on quickly to say, well, that's probably a reasonable outcome because they'll be exceeding this reasonable threshold.
Yeah, but they then get into effect. Have they got existing use rights to do the work they did?
Yep.
So that would be the difficulty if you were to impose a limit without actually understanding how it relates to the existing activity.
Yes, that's right. And we, I was just making the point that, well, I just don't have any information. So doesn't that create a bit of a problem, number one? And then number two, was this effect? It could be the limit they proposed. Could be well and truly out in terms of existing activities, and then we did talk about the sort of not so much existing use rights, but the timing between when the Wayman activity came on stream, if you like, in relation to how long the airport activity had been on for, matters of that sort. All right. Any other comments?
No.
All right, that's very good. Thank you very much indeed. That's helpful. Well, look, we might just take a break now for morning tea, if that's all right. And to take a break, stay for 15 minutes. So we've got Ms. Galavazi to come, and then we're on to the reporting officer and Mr. Winchester.
Yes.
Okay. That's good, thank you.